Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
But I think it's a convincing portrait of a very complex man. What you get is someone who's not always emotionally stable, but is genuinely patriotic, devoted to his family, not always in control, but a wonderfully gifted orator, politically astute, but could make mistakes, something of an idealist. And there's no doubt he was swimming against the tide. Harris is very, very good at describing elections. He's obviously fascinated by elections. If you look at his latest book, it's all about a papal election with shenanigans going on in the background. And in 63 BC, of course, Cicero makes the consulship. And I think in many ways the best thing for me in all three books is the end of the first book, where he gives you a fantastically vivid picture of the election itself that Cicero won. That's great writing, I think.
To be ignorant of history is to remain always a child. The insightful words of Roman orator, lawyer and politician Marcus Tullius Cicero. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to meet with two interesting writers. One a classicist and translator, the other a journalist and novelist. Writers of tremendous depth, opinion and pace. Elizabeth Day unpacks the nature of love, jealousy and desire, as teased out in her new psychological thriller, The Party. And John Davey explains how the writings and ideas of Cicero speak to the 21st century. But first, I looked at my husband on the night of the party and knew with startling certainty, I do not love you and there is no point pretending. It's like tripping over a pedal and breaking a leg. Sometimes the entire course of your life can change because of a single second. Because that single second doesn't exist in isolation. It's connected to an infinite chain of minutes, days, weeks, months and years that have gone before. But it's the misshapen second that unravels it. The engrossing words of British novelist Elizabeth Day from her latest book, The Party, published by HarperCollins.
Hello, my name's Elizabeth Day. I am an author and a journalist, and my new novel, The Party, has just been published. The Party is a story of a man who becomes dangerously obsessed with his best friend. It's been described rather delightfully as a cross between The Talented Mr. Ripley and Brideshead Revisited. It's narrated by Martin, who is a quintessential unreliable narrator. And the passage I'm reading is going to be from the night of his best friend Ben's 40th birthday party, and Martin is observing from the outside. The rich do parties better than the rest of us. It's not just the money or the every catered for whim or the superior quality of the alcohol and food. It's a certain unquantifiable atmosphere that comes from other people's excitement. We are turned on by wealth, us lesser mortals. We don't want to be, and yet we are. We are jealous, yes. Internally, we decry the excessive, absurd, narcissistic scale of a party like Ben Fitzmaurice's 40th. But other people's money has a narcotic quality. It makes you high. It makes you forget your misgivings. You feel privileged, somehow exceptional to have been invited, as though the tiniest fleck of gold leaf from a giant glittering statue has smudged off on you, and you can kid yourself you belong. That you are, for a single night, indubitably, one of them. And it was quite a party. Important to remember that now, given all that has happened since. Important to recall how decadent the whole evening felt when we were in it, senses heightened, then dizzied by the free-flowing drink. The lychee martinis, the champagne cocktails, the old fashions made with aged tequila dating from the year of Ben's birth, and, in an ironic nod to his university days, trays of potent, sickly sweet Bacardi breezers and bottles of hooch, which prompted us all to laugh at this audacious joke of his, which, in another context, seemed so common, so cheap. But because it was Ben, everyone agreed in a swooping hullabaloo of voices that it was classic, that he was a legend, and an absolute hoot and jolly good fun. Drink. So much of it. A saturation of joy. The drink poured through the night, a liquid effervescence bubbling into the corners of the house, a rolling tide which swept over and dragged us under, heads thrown back, mouths gaping open with bright, luminous laughter, echoing into the promise of the night's stretching darkness. The heady swirl of it. Images snatched into focus and lost in an ever-spinning blur. Flash of sequins, red-soled shoe, shimmering diamonds, lacquered nails, hair shot through with shining dust, a backless dress, scooped low enough to see the tip of a private fleshy crease, a bow tie, uncoiled on a scatter cushion, edges curling.
Really well done on the party, Elizabeth. I have to say it's a hugely compelling read. Very nervy in parts, very, very gripping, and very dark in other parts, and very uncomfortable. But I think that added value to the overall reading experience, because you progressively become more creeped out and uncertain as you progress through the book. So that's quite a feat to accomplish. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off. Do you think in a lot of ways we're all outside? Insiders trying to become insiders, trying to feel needed in some way, that sense of belonging, trying to fit in, that no matter where we are placed in society, whatever class or whatever background, that we're all trying to fit in?
I totally agree with that. I mean, I definitely feel, from my own personal perspective, that I have had periods of my life where it feels like I'm an outsider pressing my face against the window of a group that I want to belong to. And I think that can be as simple as at school, if you're the last person to be picked for a sports team. I mean, I still remember the crushing disappointment of that and the loneliness that you felt. And I also remember, as a child, I was born in England and I've always spoken with a very English accent. But when I was four, my family moved to the north of Ireland and we lived outside Derry. And that, again, was an experience of dislocation, because I marked myself out in the way that I spoke as a bit of an outsider. And again, there was that sense of needing to belong. And I think it's part of an innate sense of what makes us human, that drive to be part of a bigger group. Because I think it's almost primal, isn't it? It comes from it being safer to hunt in packs. So I very much hope that Martin, although as you point out, he is occasionally quite a creepy narrator, I hope that readers can relate to him, because actually it all comes from a place of vulnerability.
What were the big questions that you were asking yourself when you sat down to write this novel? It's clearly a very dark exploration of human life, of class structures and social systems. But within all of that, you're tackling a lot in relation to jealousy and obsession within friendships. You're looking at marriage, sense of trust. There's lots of big, big questions there. So I'm wondering, what was the centre of your thoughts at that time?
I think there were two main things. One is, what is love? As the famous song goes, because I think love can take many forms. And in the party, you see Martin's unrequited, suppressed love for his best friend. It starts off as a close friendship between two boys at school, but it develops into something darker, more approaching obsession. And Martin loves Ben, but never admits it to himself. But he also loves what Ben represents. He loves the world, the gilded world of people living in these big country houses and rubbing shoulders with important politicians and supermodels. He aspires to that, but can never truly be part of it. And there's also the love that is very one way, again, between Lucy and Martin. So Lucy is Martin's wife, and Lucy is married to him, but he is unable to give her what she wants. And she spends a lot of the novel quite unhappy in that relationship and trying her best to please Martin and to find some way of drawing him out of himself. But again, it's fatally unrequited. And then the other thing that I wanted to explore, which we've already touched on, is that notion of what society is, whether there is, as I think there is, an ever-increasing gap between the haves and the have-nots. I set the book in the days of the David Cameron government in the UK, and I was very concerned then that we had an era of career politicians who basically existed in a bubble. They generally went straight from Eton to Oxford University and then into politics. And it concerned me that these people might not have much of a notion of how the ordinary members of the public existed. And so I wanted to look at that as well, because I think it's one of those things that the class system still exists, but in a very unspoken way. And unless you know the secret rules, you can never truly be one of them.
Why do you think it is some people feel that when they're in love with somebody, or whether they're married or in some form of committed relationship, that they own a person? Because one of your central characters, Lucy, very much feels that she owns her husband, that she can fix her husband, that she can change her husband, and that she can almost predict or intuit his every need.
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. I think there's sort of multiple answers to that. I think Lucy's motivation is that something happened to Lucy at university that she has never recovered from, and it really shook her sense of self and her sense of identity. So I think Lucy sees attaching herself to Martin and treating him as a kind of project as a way of gaining self, because she's not sure of who she is. So she tries to latch on to someone who she thinks is more powerful than her. And that's a really bad dynamic in a relationship, because the unscrupulous person might exploit that willingness to cede power and become something of an emotional abuser, which I think is what Martin does. And emotional abuse is also all about ownership. And I've spoken to many women who were in relationships that seemed to be, on the surface at least perfectly, you know, perfectly functioning. And as soon as they got married, something changed, because their husband, and it was very often their husband, seemed to think that he had the person that he wanted. He no longer needed to court her. And that sent the relationship into a dark spiral. So I think there are many gradations of ownership within marriage. And I think the only way to get out of that power dynamic is to be truly honest from the beginning with your partner about all your vulnerabilities and weaknesses. And then if they love you for them, then hopefully they'll love you forever.
You tell the story from a variety of viewpoints. We have Martin, our key protagonist, and his wife Lucy, and we have the main object of Martin's affections, which is Ben, who is a super rich guy from elite class. He's access to the corridors of power. His wife is a particularly interesting character, Serena, isn't it?
Serena, yeah.
Yeah, Serena. And at one stage, Lucy makes an observation that everything in their life became unnecessary. And it made me laugh so much, because how you portray the social elites in society, and the, you know, their themed houses and their fancy houses that they lived in, and everything is bespoke to their every need. It all seemed so unnecessary and almost disgusting.
It does, yeah. I had tremendous fun writing Serena, actually, because she was a composite of many sort of society types that I had come into contact with. I think there's a stage that comes when you are absurdly wealthy, where you almost forget you exist within the parameters of that wealth. And for Serena and Ben, I think Lucy points out that even the number of children they had became unnecessary. So they have four children in quick succession, and they have sort of uniformed nannies wearing uniforms that are designed not to look too much like a uniform. And it's tremendous fun writing about that world, because I am not ridiculously wealthy myself. And it's quite fun observing it again from a sort of outside perspective, which is why I loved the voice of Martin, because he, like me, was sort of looking on at something that he could never fully comprehend. And I was lucky in the sense that my day job is as a journalist. And as a journalist, you get lots of privileged access that you wouldn't normally get. And my first job in journalism was as a diarist on the Evening Standard in London. And it was literally in my job description that I had to go out every night to all these terribly glitzy parties and bowl up to celebrities and ask them various questions that would hopefully make a news story for the next day's paper. And that meant that, again, I was in this position of being something of an insecure wallflower at these parties. I was only invited as a journalist. I wasn't invited as a guest. And that put me in the position of observer. And I picked up sort of lots of interesting nuggets from that particular era of my life, all of which went into describing the party of the title.
Yeah, how you write the party and the social manoeuvrings at the party, who's shaking hands with who, who's drinking what, who's eating what, and how everyone's eavesdropping on each other's conversations and competing and wanting to be noticed. It's hilarious stuff, but it's also very dark, very unnerving and very, very uncomfortable, because clearly there's so much psychology at the back of this, so much deep-rooted anxiety and competitiveness, that it makes it all so dark, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that, because this is my fourth novel. When I wrote my first novel, Scissors, Paper, Stone, I gave a copy to my mother and she read it from cover to cover and she went very quiet for a few hours and then she looked at me and said, "Are you very dark?" She's like, do you have very depressing thoughts in your head? And I don't, actually. And I think it's partly because I explore them on the page. And the darkness of the party comes from Martin's slight bitterness. But I hope that there are also moments of lightness of touch and humour in there. But I'm under no illusions that the people Martin has befriended want him for what he can give to them. They treat him almost as a mirror to admire their own success. And Martin's fatal error is to believe that that's friendship and that that's love, but actually it's a bad mistake. And that is quite a dark theme. And I write characters who act on those themes and who act sometimes in unlikable ways. But the other thing that I think is that that is life. It's a reflection of life. There is no such thing as a black or a white character. There are only shades of grey. All of us act occasionally in contradictory and complex ways. And I really steer as clear as I can from the notion of having to write quote-unquote nice characters. Mm. I think it's something that female authors are expected to do a lot of. And I just don't enjoy that, because for me, it's not realistic.
Well, none of your four main characters are anyway nice, but they're deeply interesting and complex characters. And they are a great window into the world and all the absurd hypocrisy within the world. I thought how you wrote Martin was very interesting, because clearly he's a very angry character. He is fighting a lot of battles. But within all his manoeuvrings, he's not weak in any way. He makes the most of what he's got and how he and how he tries to reinvent his world, almost an imaginary world. His backstory, though, is very interesting. His relationship with his mother. How did you go about writing that?
First of all, I just want to say, I think Lucy's a sort of nice-ish character. I feel like I would get on with Lucy if I met her. She starts off quite brittle because of the stuff that she's experienced within her marriage, but she ends up a really strong character in the book. So I just want to put in a special plea for Lucy there. In terms of Martin and his backstory, I knew that I needed, as an author, to give a reason to my readers why he wanted to be a certain way. And I am very interested in the influence our parents can have on bringing up their children effectively, and particularly interested about the relationship between single mothers and only children, because I think there's a particular kind of expectation that comes with that, because they are each other's family. And Martin is the only child of a single mother. His father dies before he's born, and he's taught sort of never to speak about his father or never to ask a question about how he died. And in that dysfunctional dynamic, their love for each other becomes warped and suffocating, because they only have each other to rely on. And then what ends up happening is that Martin is just kind of desperate to escape from his mother. And that then sends him to a boarding school where he ends up meeting Ben Fitzmaurice. And he inveigles his way into Ben's family because he feels that that can stand in as a substitute. And now he's part of this lovely sprawling family with two children and a big house and parents who seem to be nice and seem to care about him. And he's very intelligent, Martin. But all else that you can say about him, he's super bright. So he is, as you say, very adept at making the most of his situation.
He says at one stage in the novel, "I think my mother's obsessive love for me coexisted with contempt for her own vulnerability." And it's a really interesting line, because when you think that through, it leads into all sorts of frightening scenarios, doesn't it? Because it's a clearly doomed scenario.
It is. So I think what he's getting at there is the fact that his mother doesn't want to acknowledge how much she loves her son because she realizes that he is all she has. And that's where her vulnerability comes from. So instead of showering him with love, she actively seeks almost to distance herself from him because she feels that that's the only way either of them is going to survive. And again, it goes back to, I guess, a sort of warped natural instinct, you know, sort of sending your fledgling chick out of the nest to make his way in the world. But I have to say, you know, I have terrific parents. So it doesn't come from a place of autobiography at all, any of that. But I think all dysfunction starts in the family unit or in the lack of family unit. And that's why, as Tolstoy said, all happy families are alike, but each unhappy family is unhappy in its own particular way. And I do think much of great literature starts from that point, from that kind of microcosm of the family dynamic and the relationships we grow up understanding or misunderstanding.
The surprising thing on how you've written Martin's character is that as you progress through the novel, you know, he does all sorts of creepy stuff, really psycho antics, clearly very jealous, obsessed and driven within his obsession. But he is not unlikable either. And possibly it would be too strong to say that you have sympathy for him. But as you get through, as you progress through the novel and you see that all what he's grappling with in terms of social conventions and how he's being judged, you can understand how screwed up he is.
I'm so glad you said that, because I think that too. And I think that Martin stands in as a kind of underdog because you sort of end up rooting for him because the people that he's trying to befriend treat him so callously. And I like that idea as an author of playing with a reader's sympathy and also the uncertainty of whether what Martin's telling you is actually true. I love unreliable narrators. And Martin starts off as a single narrative voice. And it's only when you get the point of view of Lucy later in the book, who describes some of the same events, but in a slightly different way. And it's then that you realise that Martin actually hasn't been wholly truthful. And I think as a reader, I like reading that kind of book because you're constantly trying to put pieces of the puzzle together in your own mind. And I think that helps you become sort of enticed into the plot and pulls you forward. And that's why there's a narrative pull, I hope, in the party that makes it read like a psychological thriller.
Lucy, Martin's wife, throughout the novel goes to a therapist, I think his name is Keith. And Keith gives her lots of feedback on where she's going within her marriage and her relationship and how she understands the world around her. And it makes for very, very interesting reading because as a reader, it brings up lots of questions that the reader will put to themselves in their own lives. And I thought that was a very interesting narrative within the narrative. But at one stage, Keith, the therapist, says to Lucy, the mind has a way of organising itself. Sometimes the most important things will remain buried for a long time and we remember them only on a cellular level. And he talks a lot about muscle memory. Have you done much therapy or was it important for you to poke at, I suppose, the therapist's couch and the scenarios that present that? Because I can imagine as a writer, if you're one of your characters or one of your protagonists is on the couch, so to speak, there's so many different things you can throw in.
Yes, something that I've noticed in, I think, all of my books, there is a therapist, not necessarily a fully drawn character, but at some point I'll put someone into therapy. And I have been in therapy myself. I found it incredibly helpful for some very dark moments in my own life. And I think I find it useful as an author because it's a way of psychoanalyzing your characters on the page. And it's a way of, as you say, prodding them to greater understanding of their own motivation. So I was very clear that I wanted the character of Keith to draw out stuff that Lucy might not necessarily say to us if she were left to her own devices. And muscle memory is something that I'm also fascinated by because of my own personal experience. So I can think of several occasions where it's happened to me where a former boyfriend of mine was killed in Iraq. Tragically, he went there as a journalist and it was an incredibly shocking and devastating event for everyone who knew him. And it happened in July one year, I think it was 2004. And I just remember obviously grieving at the time. And then a year on from that, I started feeling really low around July. And to begin with, I couldn't quite work out why and what was wrong with me. And then I suddenly remembered it was year to the day. And I do think that your body has a way of suppressing things that are so difficult to grapple with until you are strong enough to be able to cope with them. And that is really what happens to Lucy as well. There's a lot of stuff she hasn't dealt with. She had a miscarriage, as did I. Similarly, when I had a miscarriage at 3 months, I went into a period of numbness and actually, I think, shock. And my best friend described it as me being behind a kind of Perspex screen that she would try and knock on to get some reaction. And I think, to be honest, I was just processing things. And it was only a few months later that I could acknowledge what had happened and then start to deal with the feelings that came from that.
I presume all those experiences have really impacted on how you approach writing a novel and whether the intensity you're willing to bring into that novel.
Yes, I guess everything that I go through in life affects how I write. And I don't mean that I write autobiographically, but I just mean that sometimes you can have a kernel of experience that can really flourish in an entirely different way on the page. And I like having those starting point. And it is, yeah, I think, I mean, hopefully I'm getting a better writer the more of life I experience. And it does definitely affect the kind of themes that I want to explore. And then a lot of it is just complete invention as well.
None of the marriages, Elizabeth, in this novel are functioning on whatever will be perceived at a normal level, whether we can say any marriage functions at a normal level. But, you know, what all four of your main characters bring into their marriage, what they're willing to do, what they're willing to sacrifice and the, you know, and their approaches within it make for a very interesting reading. And it got me thinking that is it very easy to fall out of love in marriage?
It's a great question. I think it's easy to fall out of love in any relationship because I think what happens is when you're in a relationship, particularly actually when you get married, there's almost a sense that having got married, you've done the hard work. You've kind of established yourself as a couple in the eyes of the world. You've made these vows and that's sort of it. And the biggest danger, I think, and I speak as a divorcee, I've never called myself a divorcee. It makes me sound about 85, but anyway, I think one of the biggest dangers in any relationship, but particularly marriage, is to stop tending and nurturing your relationship and to stop making time for each other and to stop communicating with each other because you think it's a sure thing. So essentially, it's about not taking each other for granted. I mean, that's my limited perspective on that. But I am a romantic at heart and I do really believe in love. I mean, that's, I think, just the guiding principle of everything. And although I explore unhappy marriages in the party, I completely believe that you can be incredibly happily married. You just have to be, I guess, honest and brave enough to be honest about yourself when you don't think you're presenting the best side of yourself to the world. And I think all the characters in the party are to an extent playing a part in their own imagination.
Yeah, it got me thinking both Serena and Lucy, within their marriages, there's a lot of pretense, a lot of make-believe, a lot of imaginary leaps. And they're all pretending to some degree, either conforming to what would be perceived as the happy wife, the good homemaker, the wonderful mother, or pretending to be interested in a marriage that they're clearly bored in.
Yes, and I think it's something that particularly affects women, and it definitely affected me throughout my 20s, is the tendency to people please. So you think, as you know, I was raised in the 1980s, and at that time, young girls were still being taught to be kind and nice and lovely and pliant, whereas young boys were being taught to sail forth and be bold and to take risks and to be adventurous and assertive. And I think the legacy of that was that I and many of my contemporaries felt that the only way we succeeded as people was to make other people like us or to make other people happy. And I think Lucy, anyway, definitely falls into that trap slightly. She's trying to please Martin, who will never be fully pleased by her. And so she finds herself trapped in this situation that she's unwittingly chosen to be in.
Lastly, what is your intention with this novel in terms of what is your hope with the novel in terms of what you hope the reader to do with it, whether it's the questions that they're exploring or asking themselves, or what's your hope?
I suppose I hope primarily that they enjoy the book. I really do, that they enjoy reading it and that they find it a really stimulating read. That's really my only hope. But beyond that, if I could have everything, I think in all the writing that I do, I seek to further understanding. I think it was E.M. Forster who said, only connect. And I do think that that's at the root of everything I try to do, which is to try and make other people feel empathetic to each other. And that's why I find it really important to write about characters who occasionally act in unlikable ways. And yet you can understand why they do. And you can hopefully have sympathy for them, if not complete empathy. And it's all about sort of connecting with other human beings. And that's really what I seek to do. And other than that, I just want to tell a really good story.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Okay, let's stick with the themes of morality and intelligence and meet with one of Rome's most celebrated orators, the great Cicero. British academic, translator and teacher John Davy has recently translated the final philosophical works of Cicero for Oxford World Classics.
My name is John Davy. I am a lecturer in classics at Trinity College, Oxford. One day a week. I'm a retired schoolmaster and I live in Devon with my wife, Jill.
Really well done on the book, John. I'm sure that, you know, with your students in the past, throwing them lines of Cicero was absolutely inspiring. And because we can all learn so much from the man's life and also from his writing, his letters, his diaries and his friendships and so on. On that note, I might start off with a bit of Cicero, if you don't mind. Cicero wrote that any man can make mistakes, but only an idiot persists in his error. It's great stuff, isn't it?
Well, Cicero was, like most of the orators of his day, he was well aware that the job in hand was to persuade the audience. Quite a lot went that would not go at all in a modern court of law. And Cicero was very good at pulling the wool over jurors. He also was very good at making them laugh and therefore taking their mind off, perhaps, the more important point that his opponent was trying to make. So I think Cicero was very well versed in the skullduggery, if you like, of the Roman bar. That's not to say he was a charlatan, but he certainly played by the rules of the day.
What do you think he'd say to Donald Trump? What do you think if you gave Cicero 5 minutes in his company or with his chief of staff? What do you think he'd be advising them on?
Carry on the way you're doing. Because Donald Trump, whether consciously or not, employs quite a few Ciceronian tropes. He's definitely into the rhetorical tricolon, and he speaks in a rather disingenuous way, which can convey a sense of sincerity. I don't think there's terribly much wrong with Trump on the rhetoric front. It's the content, I think, that Cicero would object to more than anything.
John, as I was progressing through Cicero on life and death, it got me thinking, is all politics about compromise?
I think all successful politics in any age has to be about compromise because of the human condition, if you like. Several of Cicero's contemporaries were not strong on the art of compromise, and without exception, they came to a sticky end. Julius Caesar is a good example of that, but there were others. And Cicero was a realist. He was practical, and I think he knew the importance of compromise. The one thing he would not compromise on was, of course, his allegiance to the Republic, as he saw it.
And he was quite the exponent of that. I'm just wondering, how relevant do you think Cicero's thinking, ideas and insights are to our contemporary world? He was clearly an unbelievably wise man, but you think a lot of politicians and people working in either local government or even in high-performing business life, that we can actually learn from him and his writing?
I think Cicero was, well, he was certainly regarded as wise by his contemporaries. He wasn't wise in the sense that Aristotle or Plato was wise. He was practically wise. Yes, I think politicians could learn from him. I mean, so I would focus on the moral angle. I mean, Cicero believed in the central importance of virtue in human conduct. He thinks it's the basis of the happy life and also of the supremely happy life. And he held that the truly happy life is that of the philosopher who's engaged with philosophy. That's to say, the ancient criterion, physics, ethics, and logic. But he also serves the state. He must be practical. So Cicero's relevance lies in his belief that human beings function at their best as human beings when they practice virtue, and when they strive to put considerations of justice before those of self-interest. He wrote about the duty of a provincial governor when he was in Cilicia, much against his will, in 51 BC. He said that the duty, the function of a governor is to ensure the maximum happiness of the people he is governing. That's a pretty good lesson, I think. These are not just words either. He took on a case early in his career on behalf of some poor provincials from Sicily who were being fleeced by a totally corrupt Roman governor, a rapacious character called Verres, and that made Cicero's career. It was a brave decision. He did stand for political freedom as embodied in the Republic, but the moral work, the most moral work, the one that was read and read again in the Middle Ages, was the De Officiis on duties. And I have to say, quite a lot of what Cicero said did win the approval of the Christian Church.
One of the things he really advocated on was on gratitude. And he believed gratitude was the mother of all virtues. And it starts and ends with gratitude. It makes so much sense, doesn't it?
It makes a lot of sense. The context is all important, actually, because the whole Roman social system depended on patrons and clients. Patrons were the fat cats who could afford to look after you. The client was the relatively poor man who would be fed, watered, advanced, whatever, if he helped, supported politically the patron. And this, if you think about it, ties into the notion of gratitude quite clearly. You had to show gratitude and you had to support your patron.
I'm just wondering, John, have you read much Robert Harris, have you?
Yes, I have.
And how do you think he is, what do you think he's offered in terms of our understanding, fictitious or otherwise, of Cicero and his followers and opponents?
I am a fan of Robert Harris. Yeah. I think what I like about Harris is that he always does his research. I don't think the Cicero trilogy is an exception to that. He'd obviously read a lot and he'd thought a lot about Cicero. Of course, the medium is Tyro. Mm-hmm. That's a good choice of narrator, although inevitably, you're going to get somewhat rose-tinted spectacles because Tyro obviously loved Cicero. Cicero was very good to Tyro. But I think it's a convincing portrait of a very complex man. What you get is someone who's not always emotionally stable, but is genuinely patriotic, devoted to his family, not always in control, but a wonderfully gifted orator, politically astute, but could make mistakes, something of an idealist. And there's no doubt he was swimming against the tide. Mm-hmm. Harris is very, very good at describing elections. He's obviously fascinated by elections. If you look at his latest book, it's all about a papal election with shenanigans going on in the background. And in 63 BC, of course, Cicero makes the consulship. And I think in many ways the best thing for me in all three books is the end of the first book, where he gives you a fantastically vivid picture of the election itself that Cicero won. That's great writing, I think.
I was very moved reading about Tullia, Cicero's daughter. She died in childbirth and they had a tremendously positive relationship with each other. They got on really well. They really got each other. And, you know, it struck me that possibly he got on better with his daughter than his wife. It's an interesting relationship when you think about it. I'm just wondering, do you think he ever got over her death? Because clearly he wrote loads afterwards to distract himself from the torments of grief. But he doesn't seem to have recovered, did he?
No, I think you're absolutely right. Tullia was the love of his life. He calls her in his letters Tulliola Mea. He just loved her. One thinks of, Thomas Hardy apparently had some sort of father-daughter relationship with Tess, even though she's a literary creation. He writes about my Tess. She died, as you say, after giving birth to a son early in 45. The child only lived a few months, and Cicero was distraught. He says she had been his only comfort for the loss of Roman liberty, and amazingly, he divorced his second wife. He'd only been married to her for a few months because he thought she was showing a lack of sufficient grief for Tullia's death.
You can understand that, though, even if it sounds a bit hasty, because, you know, in relationships, it's about solidarity and support. And when you feel that, you know, something as shocking and dramatic and as terrifying as losing a child isn't being properly grieved upon by your other loved ones, well, it can be perilous.
Yes, I think you're right. It was, from Cicero's point of view, it was the final blow.
Yeah.
He wrote a consolation, which was presumably an act of therapy, but it wasn't very successful. He says himself, it reduced the outward show of grief. Grief itself, I could not reduce, and would not if I could. That's very significant.
Yeah.
He almost felt it was an act of duty to mourn. You know, mourning becomes Cicero. He wanted to set up a shrine to her memory, and was only dissuaded by Atticus, who said, come on, people might think you're exploiting her death to gain glory for yourself. I don't think he was. It affects his treatment of grief in the Tusculum, when he was calmer and could be more objective. And the theme of immortality, which is presumably what he wanted by creating a shrine for Tullia, reappears in his on old age. It's all part of his incredible sense of loss. The Latin word is desiderium. No, he never got over it. You're quite right.
Desiderium. It's a lovely word. There's a power to that, isn't there?
It is. It's very powerful. It's what you feel for the absence of a loved one. So Pliny, writing to his wife back in Rome when he's out governing the Black Sea area, feels desiderium. But of course, you can never bring back someone who's dead.
You mentioned Atticus there, his lifelong pal. They were terrific friends. Intellectually, they were very much level with each other. They soundboarded different ideas, threw different things around together. And they had a huge amount of trust. And Cicero, you know, he was successful in life because he thought that, you know, by having such a true good friend by his side, that allowed him to flourish in the world. And he really advocated and wrote a lot about the values in relationships and in particularly with friendships, didn't he?
I think that's perfectly true. I mean, he was his lifelong friend, a Greek-loving Roman. He preferred to live in Athens, and Cicero, of course, loved Greek literature and the Greek life, but nothing could tear him away from Rome. He was 3 years older than Cicero, and I think he was a pretty steadying influence. He helped bankroll Cicero at times. He was a very wealthy man. He was a money lender. And of course, there was a family link because Atticus's sister married Cicero's younger brother, Quintus, who was his other best friend. I think Quintus and Atticus were his two best friends throughout his life. Atticus was a clever fellow. He kept himself politically neutral. He was a born survivor. And of course, a measure of that is his daughter married the first emperor of Rome's lieutenant, Agrippa. And their daughter became the first wife of Tiberius, who was forced to divorce her by Augustus. I suppose a measure of success in those days was that he died in bed at the age of 77, so he outlived Cicero by 11 years. And he was an Epicurean, but he wore it very lightly, and he had no enemy. As far as we can see, he had no enemies. Cicero had a pretty low opinion of Epicurus and Epicureanism. But that was no problem as far as their friendship was concerned.
John, I'm just wondering, what do you think Cicero would make of the migration crisis throughout Europe and across the Arab world? And what we're seeing in terrible violations of human rights and the trafficking of people? Presumably, he would have been appalled. But also, I would imagine from reading stuff on Cicero's life, he possibly would also have been appalled that we haven't evolved too well either.
Well, I think he would be fairly appalled, actually. One of the things that Cicero realized was that when push comes to shove, human beings will always go for self-interest over justice, and that people will dress it up in all sorts of colors. It's not a new idea. I mean, the Greeks had been saying this long before, principally the historian Thucydides. And Cicero, I don't think he was at all rosy-eyed about human nature. He knew what men were capable of. In his own day, the big threat to his beloved republic was, of course, very powerful individuals, mm-hmm. often with an army behind them, who were high achievers and were threatening the stability of the republic. Because one day they might just walk into Rome with that army and start telling the Senate what to do, which effectively is how Caesar behaved.
Cicero said that true law is right in reason with nature, and he talked about natural rights and moral goodness. I'm just wondering, how do you understand his views on moral goodness?
Moral goodness, I know, it's quite philosophical the way he puts it. Okay, I think, how can I put it? He does speak of natural law, and it's a difficult concept. I think the way I would make sense of it is that he argues that all creation seeks to be perfect according to its kind. He thinks this is the wish of nature, and he imagines nature as a universal mother. Nature gives you and me a soul. The soul is culled from the divine mind. This is a Stoic concept. The concept is that sparks of the divine fire that determines the character of the universe exist in us, and these sparks are our minds or our souls. If the human soul is cultivated, it becomes perfect. It becomes equal to absolute reason and virtue. All who possess virtue, says Cicero, are happy. In fact, they're supremely happy because they're free of emotional disturbances. They can correctly judge that what is morally good is what is only good. Things that aren't morally good don't add to human happiness. The nice story he quotes from Plato, where Plato's dinners are described as being delightful for days afterwards, when the taste of the food and the wine had disappeared, but the quality of the intellectual experience lingered on in the mind. That is what is valid. That is what matters, not expensive wine, expensive food. The crunch comes when he says nothing is better than the happy life, and nothing is better than the morally good life. Therefore, happiness and moral goodness are the same thing.
One question I have in relation to that, John, is do you think all souls are open to cultivation? I wouldn't think they are.
I think you're right. And I don't think Cicero did either. But he felt, I think, that one could try. And if you had essential goodness in you, and he seems to believe that we all have the capacity to be good, then the soul can become pure. I mean, it goes back, in a sense, to the Platonic notion that the soul is contaminated by earthly impurities, by, if you like, vice. And that's why when a man dies, his soul has to undergo a process of purification. The more pure your soul when you die, the less this is needed, the less this is necessary. But that's the essential part of you. It is an optimistic way of looking at the human condition, I agree.
We have about 700 letters of Cicero left, and I presume you've read a lot of them. I'm just wondering, within those letters, how do you think those letters have contributed to intellectual history and to our understandings of life?
Well, I think the letters are terribly important. I mean, they come in four different categories, and we've got about 1,000 of them, and they give a very detailed insight into Cicero's life and time. The main value of them, actually, is historical rather than intellectual. I would hesitate to apply the word intellectual to Cicero's letters any more than I would to anyone else's letters, really, because he's not writing for publication. He's simply writing about the nitty-gritty of life. So I wouldn't say his status in intellectual history depends upon the letters, although I have to admit they were seen as very important by Renaissance scholars like Poggio and Petrarch. And the main thing that shines out of these letters is humanitas, the humanism, which comes at the expense of, is not contaminated at all, contaminated perhaps a strong word, by the dogma of religion. There's a quotation from the Roman comic poet, Terence, in which a character says in one of the plays, "I'm a human being. I consider nothing human irrelevant to me." And that's seen as the first definition of humanism. And in some ways it is. Well, that's the quality for me that shines out of the letters. It gives you a genuine picture of the man. He's a creature of flesh and blood. He's got moments of greatness. He's got moments of pettiness. He has hopes. He has fears. I would say the main value of the letters is historical.
And if you were to share a bottle of wine and a decent meal with him, what question would you want to ask him first? What would be the big question you'd like to ask him?
The questions I'd like to ask. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good question. I'd like to ask Cicero about his view of human nature, just as you've touched upon yourself, whether he really believes that we're all capable of being supremely good, provided we just cultivate our souls. I'd like to ask him if he, what he really thought about Pompey, because it's difficult for us to know exactly what he thought about Pompey. And he rather built his career on the fact that Pompey would support him, which didn't always happen. I'd like to ask him if he felt that Caesar was entirely a bad thing. I think the answer would have been yes. And I think, finally, I'd like to ask him if he felt that Greek philosophy was indeed the answer to all our problems, as he implies more than once.
I think we're looking at six courses there, are we, John?
We are indeed.
And that was British academic, translator and teacher John Davey. Cicero, On Life and Death, is published by the Oxford World Classic Series and retails for just under €12 in paperback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Niamh McGee, who helped out with this evening's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the perceptive words of Roman politician, orator and lawyer Marcus Tullius Cicero, who once quipped, "Silence is one of the great arts of conversation." How true. Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.